All right, hello. Is anybody else super excited about the weather we've had this week?
Yeah.
Like, it maybe got a little hot a little fast. I'm not going to complain too much, though. All right, so glad everyone was able to make it tonight. I don't know about you. I love these events. But the story I'm going to tell you today is Predator versus Prey, a micro tale. And it begins with a concept that's really pretty familiar with all of us, predators and prey, right? So here's a couple of examples. We have our cheetah chowing down on a gazelle it just caught. This heron over here has caught itself a panfish. And what I believe is a corn snake has found itself a tasty little rat. And even humans, as much as we pride ourselves at being at the top of the food chain, we have our own predators to contend with, right? We have Jaws, our great white shark, our fear of whom the Discovery Channel exploits every year with Shark Week. If you happen to be in remote Alaska, you might get preyed on by a grizzly bear. And tiniest of them all, we have bacteria, right? This is the bacterium Mycobacterium tuberculosis, and causes the disease tuberculosis, as you probably inferred. And this little bug actually infects 1/3 of the world population, and in 2014 was responsible for killing 1.4 million people. It's a lot. So the motivations behind predator and prey interactions are pretty straightforward. Who wants to take a guess what that is?
They eat you?
Okay, so if you're a predator, you eat. If you're a prey, you don't want to get eaten. It's all about survival, right? So if we're being preyed on by these minuscule bacteria, do the bacteria themselves also fall prey to something else? And that's the story we're going to talk about tonight, because in fact, yes, they are. They're preyed on by viruses. So question for you. How many of you before tonight have heard of bacteria? Okay, what about viruses? All right, yeah, we have a lot of viruses and bacteria that show up in the news. Here I have some of what I'll call public health's most wanted. So we have varicella zoster, the chickenpox virus. How many of you guys have had chickenpox?
Boo.
How many of you have had the vaccine for chickenpox? Okay, nice. all right, we have the Ebola virus, which you guys have recently heard a lot about. Rhinovirus, who here hasn't had the common cold? I don't know. And representing bacteria, we have Staphylococcus aureus. You guys are probably most familiar with this for causing staph infections. Or perhaps as MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, that confounds a lot of the antibiotics doctors try to use. There's also Bordetella pertussis. This is the bug that causes whooping cough. This disease, unfortunately, has made a comeback in recent years due to a lack of vaccinations. And lastly, we have Escherichia coli. So this can be a good bug in your stomach, or it can be a bad pathogenic bug that can cause diarrhea or urinary tract infections. So you might be wondering, why in the world has she just spent all this time discussing all these bugs we already know about? Well, part of it is to show you the diversity that abounds in the micro world. We have a huge diversity in terms of viruses, what they look like, what kind of diseases they cause, and the same goes for bacteria. So, one more question for you guys. How many of you would feel comfortable explaining to your child, your grandparent, or that really annoying person on Facebook what the difference between a virus and a bacterium is? Not that many. And that's understandable, because if you look at the media, a lot of times these two terms are used interchangeably. So before we get into the story on what kind of virus preys on bacteria, I want to make sure we're all set on what the difference is. So, indulge me, please. bacteria are closer to human cells in that they are pretty self-contained. They have all the DNA they need that encodes for the proteins they need to have a functional metabolism, to replicate their DNA, to make more bacteria, to grow. Really, the only thing that bacteria lack is fuel. The same thing we do, right? And in fact, it's fuel that is what they're after when they prey on us and is a huge factor in fighting infections. If anybody remembers my last Nerd Night talk, just kidding. All right, no pressure. Viruses, however, are quite a bit more simple. They're essentially just a protein container that holds DNA inside of it. They don't have a functional metabolism, and in fact, they rely on functioning cells like bacteria or human cells in order to make more viruses. So if bacteria are these living, breathing cells and viruses are mere containers, you might ask, are viruses even alive? To be honest, well, that's a debate for philosophers, and it's a pretty hot one, so I'm not going to go into it. But if you're not quite there on the difference between the two, I'm going to leave you guys with a fun analogy before we get into the story. All right? Because they're both small, we can perhaps think of viruses and bacteria as children. Viruses are infants, essentially. They rely on some other figure, such as a parent, to provide them with everything they need, with their nutrients, clothing, feeding, transportation, all of that. If that's the case, then bacteria are that high school or college age kid who can pretty much do everything for themselves, but they still come home to raid the refrigerator and eat you out of house and home. All right, so we're all good here? Okay, so the type of virus that we're gonna talk about that preys on bacteria is commonly referred to as a bacteriophage. So the word bacteriophage, obviously the first part's pretty straightforward, bacterio, bacteria. Phage, however, is actually a Greek term that means to devour. So these kinds of viruses are literally called bacteria devouring viruses. Pretty cool. What do these guys look like? Well, most of them look like this. They have a large head, and some have this large tail component, and joining the two is this itty bitty collar. And it might remind you...
A Russian satellite?
Okay. Anybody else? A spider? Yeah? How about the lunar landing module? Maybe a little bit more sleek and refined looking version, but hey. All right. So this structure that you see here is made up of proteins that fit together like puzzle pieces, and then they contain DNA inside the head portion of the bacteriophage, which I'll sometimes refer to just as phage. So what then does the virus, these phages, what do they have to do in order to actually infect the bacterium? We'll walk through that. First, in any predator-prey interaction, the predator has to catch its prey, right? So for the phage, we're going to call this step one, the attachment phase. The virus, phage, has this handy little landing platform in the tail. And it recognizes specific features on the surface of the bacterium. So if it's coming along and it bounces onto a bacterium and recognizes the surface feature, which can be a lot of different things, so it's just feature, it will bind similar to how a lock fits into a key. It's extremely specific. So it latches on, and here we have attachment. Next, step two is entry. The process of the virus attaching or docking onto the bacterial surface turns the tail from a landing platform into a hypodermic needle. And the tail injects this phage DNA here from the head into the bacterial cell. After this, we have what I call zombification of the cell. Now, if you read through the announcement for this, it was the zombie virus. And many people are concerned about, the zombie virus. Well, let me tell you, all viruses are zombie viruses because all of them require taking over the essential machinery of the cell it invades in order to get new viruses out. So all viruses are zombie viruses. It's already there, don't worry. So the phage DNA takes over the bacterial cell, pumps out more copies of this phage DNA, and then also pumps out more of these proteins that need to be assembled into new bacteriophages. Now the cell will pump out more and more and more and more of this DNA and protein and more of these phages until eventually, pop, goes the weasel, and the phage have lysed the cell. And this releases the phages out to go infect new bacterial cells. So because this process ends in lysis of the cell, or bursting of the cell, we call this the lytic infection of a bacterium by phage. So we have the attachment, the entry, the zombification, assembly, and eventually the lysis. So you might be wondering, what does this actually look like besides these cartoons? So that's what this image is for. Here we have, our large bacterial cell. You can see that my depictions are not to scale because here the phages are quite a bit smaller. This particular cell is way, way outnumbered by phages, so they're docked all over the outside of the bacterial cell. At least one of them has managed to inject its DNA into the bacterial cell, and that cell is now making more of the phages with them, as you can see here. So pretty much every virus, every bacteriophage is going to go through some form of the lytic infection process. There are some viruses, however, that have a second option, the latent infection. Here, the first two steps are the same. We have attachment, we have entry of the phage DNA, but instead of the zombification process that would happen next in the lytic infection, we have what I call sleeper cell activation. So, in this process, the phage DNA basically goes into hideout mode. And instead of taking over the cell, deftly inserts itself or integrates onto the bacterial chromosome. So many of you guys are probably pretty familiar with human DNA, which is when you think about human chromosomes, there are these X's that you can see lined up inside the cell. Bacterial cells have quite a bit less DNA, and it's more efficient for bacteria to package their chromosomal DNA in the form of the circle you see here. So we get integration of the viral DNA into the bacterial DNA. And then what do you guys think happens next? The cell replicates. That is precisely what happens. This phage has infected one bacteria, bacterium replicates, and now we got two infected bacteria, and then four, and then eight, and so on and so forth. So you get kind of a 10 for the price of one for this virus. That is until the bacteria encounter some stressor. The stressor could be in the form of antibiotics that will kill the bacteria. This stressor could be a lack of nutrients that the bacteria are getting ready to starve to death. In either case, this triggers the virus that the cell is about to die, and that viral DNA will leave the bacterial DNA and start the zombification process and basically finish off with the lytic cycle. So it seems like a pretty good strategy, right? The latent infection, you get 10 for the price of one. But another factor to consider is that just as it's difficult for the predator to catch the prey is simultaneously trying to escape the predator, right? And bacteria have some pretty nifty tricks up their sleeve for trying to avoid predation by phages. One of these is by stopping attachment of the phage in the first place. So here, this particular phage binds to a yellow pentagon, all right? Well, what happens if this bacteria changes that surface feature from a yellow pentagon to a red square? Well, the phage bounces off and looks for a virus or for a bacterium that it can actually infect. Success for the bacteria. Another way to avoid phage predation is that, all right, so attachment was successful. What can we do next? Well, we can stop the zombification process from occurring. And one of the most common ways to do that is to basically degrade the phage's DNA. So bacterial DNA has this really nifty trick that's called methylation. So there are enzymes inside the bacterial cell that it put these methyl groups, one carbon and three hydrogens, at random places, well, they're not random, but at specific places on the bacterial chromosomal DNA. And this is basically a barcode for that type of cell's DNA. If there is DNA that doesn't have this barcoding on them, then it gets recognized by enzymes inside the cell whose job is to degrade any DNA that's not barcoded in the correct way. So the phage DNA comes in and it gets chewed up before it can take over the cell. But if the prey adapts, the predator has to adapt or die, right? So for every adaptation you have of the bacterium, you have an adaptation of the phage. So we get a phage that can now bind to the red square, or a phage that has learned how to evade those DNA degrading enzymes, whether it's by adding their own barcoding methyl groups or by making a protein that stops the enzyme from acting. So I've just told you about one particular type of virus. You remember, in the beginning, there's this huge diversity of viruses that prey on humans and this huge diversity of bacteria that prey on humans, but there's just as much diversity in the bacteria that prey on other bacteria, or I'm sorry, not that, just as much diversity in the phages that prey on bacteria. That's what we're actually talking about. So the ones I just showed you is a classic example of a virus or bacteriophage from the Caudyovirales family. But there's diversity even in this group. So you have like the phage with a big head and short stubby tail, or maybe it has a longer tail, or a standard length tail, but it can actually contract, kind of like a spring. There's also the inaviridae group of viruses, phages. And these are really long and filamentous. There's the cystoviridae. The cystoviridae are quite a bit different from the Caudyovirales group, excuse me. Not just in how they look, they don't have this tail, but also in the fact that the entirety of the virus needs to get into the bacterial cell before it can take over the cell. Just getting the DNA in there isn't enough. And lastly, we have these, what I think are pretty adorable looking tectoviridae. So they're smaller, and I think the tectoviridae are particularly interesting because there's one type of phage in this group that infects the Bacillus thuringiensis. Is that familiar to anybody? BT? So Bacillus thuringiensis is a bacterium that actively infects and kills the insects that prey on crops like corn. So if you like Bacillus thuringiensis for protecting your crops from corn, then you may not want this particular phage hanging around. So there's this huge amount of diversity, and as it turns out, bacteria and viruses replicate pretty quickly. So E. coli, you can get full replication within say 20 minutes. So in 20 minutes, one bacterium can completely divide. Mycobacterium tuberculosis, it takes 24 hours to get full division, but either one of those is still a heck of a lot faster than a rabbit takes to reproduce. So this makes it extremely useful and easy for us to study this predator-prey interaction inside a research lab. And being the humans we are, we can take this. You're humans, I'm not, I'm a nerd. So we can take this information and we can exploit it ourselves. So some ways we have gone about doing this is, well, one, we can learn a heck of a lot about evolution and how evolution happens and what types of factors affect evolution, which could help us with issues such as climate change, for instance. So another option is we can use the methods that phages use in order to devour bacteria, in order to kill antibiotic-resistant bacteria. They're not responding to the antibiotics we have. What strategies can we learn from the phage in order to kill them? Some phage have a protein called a lysin, and it actually activates the lysis of bacteria at the end, and maybe we can use that. Something you may have heard about in the news is CRISPR-Cas. I'm not gonna go into detail about what this is or how it works, but so there's a great Radiolab podcast on that, by the way. But this is a bacterial evasion strategy, and it has turned out to be really useful for scientists because we can very quickly and very easily edit specific pieces of DNA. Lastly, we can actually use the intact phages to kill off bacteria. The beauty of the phage is that it only infects one particular type of bacteria. So if there's a phage that infects E. coli, it only infects E. coli. It won't infect tuberculosis, it won't infect human cells. So if we want to target E. coli in your gut for some reason, gosh darn it, we can do it using that particular phage. And this has been really useful in agriculture, of late anyway, because agriculture's come under pretty heavy fire for using a lot of antibiotics to fatten up livestock quickly. So instead of using antibiotics, some farmers have switched over to using specific phages. And the beauty of this is that for, again, every bacterial evasion there is, there's a phage that can adapt and infect that bacteria. So with that, I would love to encourage you to learn more at mysciwriters.com. So I'm a graduate student at the University of Michigan, and myself and some other students have been working on a blog about science and science communication. And I put up a blog post this week where you can learn more about this topic, or maybe you want to share it with a coworker and fuzzy on that one little detail, you know, quick reference, easy to do. So check out the blog, follow us on Twitter, and I would be more than happy to take any questions.